This last week has been a significant week. And I don't know if this thing will work. There we go. I know, Judy, you didn't know. Maybe somebody told you. This last week, Clark and Judy welcomed a grandson, Quade, arrived Tuesday, October the 8th, and he is beautiful. Look at that. I don't know. I never get tired. I had 8 of them, and, you know, they're beautiful. They're just beautiful. And now I've got 3 grandkids. That, by the way, was the same day that Jenny and I arrived back from Australia, where this is the other end of life. We were visiting with her 92-year-old mom, Joan, and had a wonderful time with her. This was northwest of Sydney, for those of you who know Australia at all, in a little town called Dungog, and had a wonderful time with her. I just have to say this, you know, the jet lag is a real killer. So if I fall asleep during the message this morning, you will forgive me, as I have forgiven some of you. And I won't mention any names this morning. You know, it's interesting, I just hitchhiking on this. Life inexorably moves from birth to old age. And you know, there are some things that never change. It was Benjamin Franklin who famously said that in this world nothing is certain except death and taxes. But old Ben was wrong. There's another thing that is certain in this life. We all know it, and that is that suffering is an inescapable part of life. And I just want to say at the outset this morning that those who learn to trust God in the midst of life's trials are those who will experience abundant life. I'm just going to say that again because those words fly by and they're not anything you can read anywhere. I haven't put them down. But those who learn to trust God in the trials of life experience abundant life. That's where we're going to be going this morning. If you have found Genesis 39, this is the fourth stop in our train ride or our journey through the life story of Joseph. And as this chapter, Genesis 39, opens, Joseph is in slavery in Egypt. Now, this may seem like an anachronism. You know, what are we talking about slavery for? It is actually a fact that there are millions in the world today who are effectively in slavery. But in those days, in antiquity, in Joseph's day, 4,000 years ago in the Middle East, slavery was a part of the culture. It was a part of life. But the way that Joseph had ended up in slavery was anything but normal. He was sold into slavery by his own brothers. And as far as slavery goes, being a slave in Egypt was not the best place to have ended up either. After all, those who travel to Egypt today, I don't know if any of you ever traveled to Egypt, I have not, but in Egypt today, thousands and thousands of people flock to see the ruins of temples, of the Sphinx, of the pyramids. And they probably don't stop often to think that all of those were built with the whips at the back and the blood and the sweat of slaves. So Joseph isn't in a good place. But God has a different plan for him. I'd like you to just read with me the first six verses of Genesis 39 this morning. I am sure that this is going to work. Let's see. There we go. This is when life isn't fair, and this is Genesis 39, starting at verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put to his charge. It came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned, in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge, and with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Let's ask the Lord for his guidance. Lord, as we open your word, we're going to ask you by your Spirit to open our hearts and our minds. Lord, deliver us, save us this morning from taking a look at your word and then looking away and not being changed. And instead, remind us that like a mirror, your word is there to reveal to us the areas in our lives, every one of us, that we need to address in our relationship with you. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, back in Genesis 37, and those of you who were not here a couple of weeks back, I've been gone for a couple of weeks in Australia, so Gary has been sharing with you from the book of Philippians, but when we were back in Genesis 37, we learned some things about Joseph. And it's important for us to know something about the star of the story. Joseph was raised in a dysfunctional family. But despite the fact that his father and his brother were both dishonest and dirty dealers, they didn't have great records, Joseph displayed real character. In fact, he shines as an example of honesty and integrity. So when he is sold into slavery by his depraved brothers, most of us feel like shouting, "That isn't fair. Joseph deserves to be the winner." Now, I want to just share one of my favorite scenes in movies this morning. Those of you who know this movie already know what I'm talking about. This is an old movie, but it's a classic. In fact, it's been voted one of the top quotable movies of all time, The Princess Bride. And in this movie, a grandfather is reading his grandson a story. And in the story, it comes to a point where he's reading, and the beautiful princess, he reads, marries this wicked prince, Humperdinck. And if you don't know the story, just follow along. It's totally wrong. And he reads it, and the grandson knows that's wrong. And he says, hold it, Grandpa. You read that wrong. She doesn't marry Humperdinck. She marries Wesley. I'm just sure of it, he says. After all he did for her, if she didn't marry him, it wouldn't be fair. And Peter Falk, the grandfather, replies, well, who says life is fair? Where is that written? Life isn't always fair. He's right, of course. And it wasn't fair that Joseph ended up in Egypt as a slave. But that isn't the end of the story. Now, what we've just read in verses 1 through 6 about Joseph in Egypt is obviously a turn that's unexpected. Joseph is blessed by God. He lands on his feet in Egypt like you can't believe. First of all, he is sold to a wealthy and powerful and influential man in the Egyptian government. He's the head of the Pharaoh's guards. This was like being, with the Secretary of State or the Vice President. He was hired to go to his house. And not only that, but Joseph distinguishes himself in Potiphar's house. He's got something that none of the other slaves has. So much so that Potiphar puts Joseph in charge of all of the other slaves. And then God blesses Potiphar's house so that everything in his house, everything in his lands, everything is starting to just come up roses. The stocks that he owns are going all up. The crops that he's raising are all coming back 100-fold. Everything is working out great. And so he senses that this is something, in fact, that's what the text says. He sensed there was something about Joseph that was doing this. And so he put Joseph in charge of his household completely, it says. It says that he didn't worry about anything except what he was eating. Joseph had the run of the place. In today's lingo, we might say he made Joseph his chief of staff. And then at the end of this part of the revelation, in verse 6, right at the end, the narrator drops in this little phrase. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. You know, that's a tame translation. It's interesting, the Hebrew adjective that's used here, translated handsome or other things, it's yapeh, and in Hebrew, it's almost always used of women. No offense, men. I think that we can be good looking. But yapeh means beautiful. It described a beautiful woman. But here it is applied to Joseph. Joseph was beautiful. Now, listen, I think guys can be beautiful, but, you know, girls, maybe you would be more comfortable saying, yeah, he's beautiful. I don't know, but for me, I like he was handsome and good looking. One Hebrew scholar translates this literally, he was well built and handsome. Evidently, he had a six pack and he was really buff. He was a good looking guy. He made the girls turn and look at him. Now that may sound like a soap ad, but let's move on from that. We're set up for what is about to happen. Because at this point, the narrator wants us to be cheering. We, after all, know that Joseph is a good guy. And so we're going to all be saying, all right, it's about time that Joseph caught a break after those losers of his brothers sold him into slavery. And three times in these first six verses, we read that God was with Joseph, or God was making him successful. But just when we're about to say, and they lived happily ever after, that's not the end of the story. Things start going from good to bad, what I call the good, the bad, and the ugly. But they start going from good to bad in verse 7. And what we read, we won't read it all this morning, but Potiphar's wife, she sees Joseph, and she likes what she sees. And she starts making passes at him. And every guy in this room probably knows what this is like. And girls, maybe you do too. The way that you can dress, or the way you can move or something, just to catch the eye. And Potiphar's wife is with him in the house. He's, after all, running the place. And she is doing everything she can to catch his eye. But he's not paying attention. He's going about his work. And so she starts making her intentions well known. She keeps inviting him to go to bed with her. And Joseph says no. He says, I've been entrusted with something by your husband, my master. I'm going to do what I have been told to do. And furthermore, that isn't something that I would do. And he keeps rebuffing her until one day when, as luck would have it, all the other servants had been given the day off. He was there alone. She cornered him. She grabbed him and she said, come to bed with me. And in that moment, there are a whole host of reasons why Joseph could have and even might have given in to temptation. No doubt many of us would have, but Joseph does not. In verse 12, we read that she had a grip on his cloak, and so he left his cloak behind and ran. It says he fled and went out of the house, out where there were other people, so that he would not have that powerful temptation. This is a breathtaking scene, and Joseph's commitment to purity and his master's trust is truly amazing. And I suppose you would say that if this were an act in a play, we would all rise as one and give him a standing ovation. Good job, Joseph. You, the man. But that's not the end of the story. Because right when we're ready to give him the gold medal, it all goes horribly wrong. Starting in verse 13, going through verse 20, Potiphar's wife accuses Joseph of sexually assaulting her. She claims that when she screamed, he left his garment, and that's why she had it. And when Potiphar hears this, Joseph is thrown in jail. Talk about a roller coaster life. Joseph in Canaan is living an honest life, upstanding, and he's sold into slavery by his brothers. Then he goes to Egypt as a slave and becomes chief of staff in Potiphar's house. So he's risen to the top, if you will, again, only to end up in jail charged with sexual assault. But that's not the end of the story. The rest of Genesis 39, the last three verses, the narrator tells us that God was with Joseph even in jail, that he distinguished himself again, this time from all of the other prisoners, and distinguished himself so much that the head jailer put him in charge of all of the other prisoners. In fact, the language here states that he put him in charge of the jail. Can you imagine this? A person who's been put in jail and he's running the outfit. That's how good Joseph was. At the end of Genesis 39, there are two things you can say about Joseph. First, he gets treated badly, even though he does what is right. And secondly, Joseph made the most of the bad situations he was put in. You know, this happened almost 4,000 years ago, about 3,900, I think, although we're a little bit foggy on the exact dates. But that doesn't mean this isn't applicable to us today. Temptation to commit sexual sin still happens, doesn't it? It never has ended. Being falsely accused of something that you didn't do hasn't ended. That's happened in our recent memory. And in case you haven't noticed, Christians, both here in America and around the world, suffer for doing what is right. So what are the lessons that you and I can apply? If you are a Christ follower this morning, what is it that we can extract from this divine revelation that we can now set down and, like a matrix, we can say this is what the pattern is, what God is communicating in this passage for us? We have to be careful, because in the Old Testament, it's easy for us just to make up kind of a moral of the story, like we do with Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny or Moby Dick or anything else. But here we have to ask ourselves, what is the divine author writing this for? What is it that he wanted God's people in the Old Testament as well as today for us to see and for us to apply to our lives? Well, the first thing that I would say is this. Joseph is a model of moral strength in tempting circumstances. This is the major crisis in this story. In fact, if you notice in the way that the narrator has crafted this story, he begins with Joseph rising to the peak in Potiphar's house. And then in the middle, you have this crisis that happens. That's so unjust that we all want to shout out, that's not fair. And then at the end, the last three verses, he has him rising, although he's now in jail, incarcerated, yet he is rising again. But the crisis, the sexual temptation that Joseph faces in his encounter with Potiphar's wife is something that anyone in every generation will know about. Joseph resists the temptation. Now, if you read romance novels or if you watch practically anything that comes out of Hollywood, you know that the general response to this situation is to indulge, to accept it. After all, it's there, it's on a platter. Take it. Joseph exhibits a strength of character and he holds fast to his moral integrity. And I don't mean to point fingers, because if I pointed one at you, there'd be three pointing back at myself. But guys, I think almost any of us would have been very prone to fall. Sexual temptation today is Satan's most effective tool for ruining the lives of Christian men. And I'm going to add something. In the last 30 years of pastoral ministry, it's become a fair and balanced temptation. It's getting a lot of Christian girls as well. Joseph's temptation is a textbook case. Satan had every one of his dominoes lined up. Listen, here it is. First of all, Joseph was alone and he was far from home. He had impunity. There was nobody in Egypt who would know it. This is like a businessman who's gone on a business trip. He's away from home. He's at the hotel. And you know, if he does something, who's going to know? Nobody will know. He can do it with impunity. That's one of the times that temptation is the strongest. So much so that there are Christian ministries that are just designed for Christian businessmen to help them when they are gone from home so that they will keep themselves from sin. Because I tell you something, it's difficult. It is a huge battle. Secondly, Joseph was in a position of power. He could have named his price. He was the number one guy. And here, this girl wanted him? Of course! Yeah, I'll take what I want. After all, I'm the big cheese. I'm the one who gets what I want. We see this happening in society today all the time. Thirdly, the text has told us Joseph was attractive. He was handsome and good-looking. Now, guys, most of us, like me, you know, we don't know what that means. But there are some here that do. And you know something, that if you are one of those attractive guys, that, you know, they're going to be girls that will, you know, they'll want to dangle themselves in front of you. And Joseph had that. The last thing I would say is that Joseph had it rough. And this is something that Satan will do to us all the time. Yeah, you've had it hard. Yeah, your marriage isn't that good. You know, it just isn't everything you want it to be. So you deserve this. You deserve a break today. So get up and go for all the gusto you can. That attitude is something that has bled into the mindset of our society with a vengeance today. And it was there, all of it, for Joseph. So you want to know, what was Joseph's secret? Do you know that in the text, there is no process here? It doesn't say, now, Joseph did this first of all. He called his family back home and said, hey, I'm being tempted, you know, please help me. And no, he couldn't do that. What are the two things that gave Joseph strength? First of all, Joseph, we read all the way back when we first are introduced to him in Genesis 37, he had cultivated a heart that was submissive to God. And secondly, he ran. Those are the two things. He cultivated a heart that was submissive to God. But that's not enough. Secondly, he ran. That two-step method, I submit to you, can help every one of us win over sin. In the New Testament, Paul exhorts his young protege, Timothy. Remember, what does he say to him? Timothy, flee from youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. See the two things there? One was fleeing, one was pursuing. Joseph had pursued a life of submission to God and his will. And when he was in the moment of temptation, he fled. Every Christian today can cultivate a heart that desires to obey God by, and I'm going to just suggest this specifically, there are other ways, by being in a group, getting in a small group. Men, you need to be meeting with a few other guys, Christian guys. I don't care whether it's 2 or 5 or 10, meet with guys just so that you can have a time where you can share, you can pray a little bit, you can read some of God's Word. You need it. I need it. We all need it. Women, you need it as well. That's the first thing. But second thing is, when the moment of sin comes calling, do what Joseph did. He fled. And it says he went outside. I once heard an old Bible teacher say, the only way to fight sin is on the dead run. Stop dabbling in sin. If you know there's a place, and that place is going to be a place, or that website is going to be a website, or that person is going to be a person that is going to weaken your resolve to follow the Lord, then flee. Don't wander in. That's what Joseph knew. And you and I know it too. Second thing from this story that you have to look a little closer for is this, and that is that our faith in God is strengthened each time we resist sin. Now, Joseph didn't grow up in a vacuum. I've already told you his family was dysfunctional. And if you want to read about it, you can read about it, going all the way back about 10 chapters. And you read about this. The family that Joseph was born into was a bummer. Even though they were God's chosen people, they weren't really living like it, okay? So there's a lot of a mess going on here. And yet in the midst of this, it's almost like you find a diamond in the middle of a bunch of old stones. Because Joseph stands out. He was surrounded by brothers who were deceitful and violent, and he had to dedicate himself. It was not something that just happened automatically. And so it's something that took time, and it will take time in every one of our lives, and that is that you'd make a commitment that I am going to set myself apart to God. That will start with each morning, every morning, of just saying that. Lord, I'm your man today. Use me today. That doesn't mean that that day's going to be a perfect day. You may stumble that day, but the next day you start it again. You set a pattern for yourself. And yet sometimes we paint our biblical heroes, like Joseph, as if they were supernatural. That's a fallacy. They were very human. They were subject to the same things we are. Joseph had simply determined to put God first in his life, and that storehouse of strength that he had built up in times of peace, when he came to a conflict, he was able to draw on that. But there's more here. Joseph had been sold into slavery by his brothers. Now, I realize it's a very difficult thing for you and I to imagine being sold into slavery by our own brothers. But I suspect that if we were, we'd be angry. We'd be looking for retribution. And later on in the Joseph story, we're going to find out that that does not happen. But we find out here something about Joseph's character, and that is that even though he had been sold into slavery, when he goes down to Egypt as a slave and he's sold into slavery in Potiphar's house, what did he do? He was still living a life of integrity and honesty. So that even when his boss's wife gives herself to him for sex, he says no to that. That would have been, hey, it's my turn. You know, after all, I've taken what was bad. I ought to be able to take what is good. God blessed him with success. Then he gets falsely accused. And he's thrown in prison. But you know what? I think that because Joseph had that first time when his brothers sold him into slavery, he retained his integrity. That the second time when Potiphar's wife has him thrown in prison, now he is even stronger to maintain that integrity. And I submit to you that every time you resist sin, God will strengthen your faith to stand against it the next time. The last thing that comes from this passage is about God. And isn't this all about God, really? God rewards those who deny sin and self and follow him. This is really the greatest lesson because of the way that God rewards. Let's just imagine for a minute that you and I are, we're career counselors. And this is the end of the story of Joseph. Genesis 39. What would a career counselor say? Man, you picked a bad trajectory, man. You know, going from being your dad's favorite son to being a slave to being in prison. That you're going the wrong direction here. And yet, if you read this story, you don't get that impression, do you? Instead, you see that even though, humanly speaking, Joseph's life path seems to be going this way, that spiritually, you see his life path going that way. And that's because woven into the narrative again and again is the Lord's blessing. It's there in verses 2, 3, 5, 6, 21, and 23. Over and over again, the Lord was with him. The Lord was blessing him. The Lord was doing something for him. Joseph suffered for doing what was right. And you and I may well suffer for doing what is right too. But even in the time that he was suffering, the narrator wants us to see that there is, behind the curtain, there's an unseen hand of God that is at work. You know, I don't know what trials you and I will face this coming week. You may. Some this week, or this month, or this year. This morning, Christians all around the world are enduring hardship for their faith. And often it's just the circumstances of life that we have. And we can get upset. I know. In fact, it's very tempting sometimes for us to say, Lord, listen, I'm trying to live a godly life. Can't you kind of work things out for me? I need that job. My marriage is not working right. I want this guy or this girl to take notice of me. Or, I don't know what direction my life is going in. What is it? Whatever that may be in your life this morning, just those circumstances, you may be wondering, Lord, why aren't you working that out? Why don't you heal my sickness? Why don't you solve my problems? Why don't you make me happy? What have you done for me lately? But the message of this story is that while we may endure hardship, God is not unaware of our faithfulness to Him. He's not unaware. He knows it. And He will reward us. And the study in the back for further study, I put a number of scriptures, but I want to close with this one. Peter, a man who was up and down in his life, really understood this principle. And he wrote this, 1 Peter 2:19 and 20, for this finds favor if, for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if, when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? Grapple with these last words. But if, when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God.